With me now is Kevin Trenberth. He's head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Hello, sir.
Good day to you.
So, you know, with all the hurricanes that have been going on and the amount of destruction in Florida and along the Gulf Coast, a lot of folks are talking about it. And in fact, the question comes to me, people say, hey, you do a program on the environment. What does this have to do with global climate change, if anything? So what do the hurricanes have to do with climate change, if anything?
Well, the way I think of it is that the hurricanes would be there anyway, but the global climate change and global warming in particular creates a different background environment in which the hurricanes are working. And in particular, the sea surface temperatures are a little warmer. The whole environment is a bit wetter, a bit moister. There's more humidity. And that's the main fuel for the hurricanes. As a result, the hurricanes are a bit more intense. And in particular, the rainfall that comes out of them is somewhat greater than it would otherwise be. And the best estimate we have is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 15% over the last 30 years.
So what you're telling me is that we're not seeing any more hurricanes than we might have seen in the past, but the ones that we are seeing are more intense?
Well, that applies to any tropical disturbance. So there may be a tropical disturbance that sort of gets pushed across the threshold and then counts as a hurricane, whereas otherwise it wouldn't. But in general, that is the idea, yes, that things are a bit more intense and more rainfall coming out of these things.
Now, on some of the observations for global climate change, we've seen the seasons shifting, spring coming earlier in some places, fall a little bit later. What about the season for hurricanes? What changes in the timing of hurricanes might we be seeing?
Certainly, there's a number of factors there, and it also relates to where hurricanes form. As the season gets later, you know, currently we're in September, and as we go into October, November, hurricanes still continue to form, but they tend to be a little closer to the equator, a little farther south, and they don't track northward as readily, it seems. And so they can meander around a little bit more, and so it affects the tracks. But indeed, as we move into a warmer climate, the hurricane season may well be extended a little bit at both ends.
So, in fact, we may be seeing a longer hurricane season. It might start earlier and last longer then.
It may start earlier and last longer, and it may also be a little bit more extensive. There may be some regions of the world in the tropics where hurricanes form that otherwise they might not have been quite vigorous enough to be called a hurricane.
Now, I've also heard that, in fact, some research that you talked with us about on the program a number of years ago, that the El Nino phenomenon that involves warm water in the Pacific, when that's really going, it tends to make hurricanes less. What's going on with the El Nino phenomenon now, and how might that affect the hurricanes that that folks see here in the eastern part of the United States?
Well, the regional aspects of this become very important. What happens with El Nino is that a lot more of the action in the atmosphere, especially thunderstorms, tropical storms, even hurricanes or typhoons, shift out into the Pacific, and they tend to get suppressed somewhat in the Atlantic and also even over in the Indian Ocean. And so there's sort of a competition throughout the tropics as to where the main action occurs. And so as an El Nino develops, indeed, there is some suppression in the Atlantic, but there's an enhancement out in the Pacific, and it seems as though maybe the global number of hurricanes is more nearly constant, but where they occur certainly varies.
So what are we looking at now? As I understand it, an El Nino is beginning to develop?
The sea temperatures are running about 1 to 1.5 degrees Celsius above normal, you know, as much as 3 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, out near the dateline. And it certainly looks like an El Nino beginning to form, but it's not having a profound influence on the atmosphere at the moment. And so it's not having much influence on what's going on in the Atlantic at the current time. But it looks as though the current forecast is indeed that there will be perhaps a moderate El Nino for this coming winter season that will affect the weather, where the storm tracks occur, and so on.
but not likely to stick around until the next hurricane season is what sounds like.
Well, that's a big question at the moment that's probably very difficult to answer.
My apologies for asking you to be a weather person. You study global climate systems, and I'm asking you about fairly short-term weather.
Well, I used to be a weather guy.
Uh-huh. Well, how much is the weather changing?
Well, this is how climate change actually gets manifested, of course. The changes in the hurricanes are consistent with the changes we see in precipitation across the United States. The tendency has been for all of the rainfall events that occur to be somewhat more intense than they were in the past. So we're getting fewer moderate rains and more heavy rains and more instances of potential flooding as a result of that. Although, of course, whether you get flooding depends a lot on the ministry, Corps of Engineers, or other bodies, local councils, and so on, as to how well they do flood mitigation.
And at the risk of sounding like this is a simple question, why are these changes happening?
The global warming aspects relate to the changes in composition of the atmosphere, the buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which is related to the burning of fossil fuels. And so this relates to our energy use. And we've got very clear evidence that the composition of the atmosphere is changing. These gases are greenhouse gases, and so they trap the Earth's radiation back out to space, and they produce a warming, sort of like acting as a blanket on the planet Earth. And this means that the global mean temperature goes up, but also global water vapor in the atmosphere goes up, and that provides even a feedback because water vapor is itself a greenhouse gas.
The other day, there was a discussion in the press, some testimony on Capitol Hill, where some scientists were saying hurricanes aren't related to climate change. How accurate was that, the impression that I got from those reports?
Well, there's certainly a lot of what goes on with hurricanes, which you might regard as simply being natural variability, but it's impossible for hurricanes not to be affected by the changing environment that they are operating in. And I think that statement cannot be right.
Give me the basics here. How does a hurricane get formed?
Well, a hurricane is a collective of individual thunderstorms, and there are disturbances in the Atlantic. There are disturbances which come off of Africa. The different gradients between the desert and the southern coast and the topography in the land versus ocean forms disturbances which propagate in the trade winds out into the Atlantic. And then the question is this enough to organize the thunderstorms into a collective where they can feed back on themselves and start a circulation that ends up as a tropical storm and ultimately a hurricane? In some cases, the wind environment may not be favorable. There may be subsiding air, and there may be what the scientists call wind shear that tends to blow the hurricane apart before it can really form. So this relates to the vertical structure of the forming hurricane and whether the winds at the surface are reasonably compatible with the winds in the upper part of the atmosphere. So if these things are favorable and come together, then the hurricane can get going, and then the hurricane is feeding on the water vapor and the latent heat involved in the water vapor. This is the heat that went into evaporating the moisture in the first place, and then when it falls as rain, that heat comes back, and that's the driver of the hurricanes.
So it's a feedback loop. It just keeps feeding on itself then.
That's correct, yes.
So, and one other question about hurricanes. Why do they seem to almost always end up in this rather narrow part of the United States and the Caribbean? It's only really a few hundred miles wide that these storms seem to come to.
Well, the western part of the tropical oceans is where the warmest water lies. And so hurricanes don't form in the eastern part of the oceans. For the most part, although there are a few right along the coast of California in the Pacific, but out in most of the central and eastern Pacific, hurricanes don't usually form. And on the far western Pacific, they're actually called typhoons, and over in the Indian Ocean, they're called cyclones more than anything. Hurricanes form in regions where the sea surface temperatures are above about 27 degrees Celsius, and currently in the Caribbean and in the region of the western part of the Atlantic, The sea temperatures are running about 29 degrees Celsius. They're about 1 degree, 1.5 degrees Celsius above normal in places.
So the sea is a hotbed, literally, then, of hurricane potential right now in the western Atlantic near the Caribbean.
Yes, and the pattern of sea temperatures is very much determined by the winds. And so the fact that there are easterly trade winds, the northeast trades and the southeast trades in the southern hemisphere, means that the warmest water tends to lie over on the western side of the oceans.
Now, at the National Center for Atmospheric Research there in Boulder, you spend a lot of time conducting studies yourself and also looking at a lot of the other data that's being generated around the world. What's the most interesting new data that's coming out of your work and the work of others right now in the area of trying to understand global climate change?
Well, the thing that I find most interesting, I'm very much involved in where all of the energy is going in the climate system. And so the energy is coming in from the sun. As I mentioned, the greenhouse effect traps some of that energy. And so where does the energy go? And some of that energy is going into the ocean, and one consequence of that is sea level rise. And so in the last 10 years, we've had about 1.25 inches sea level rise globally. And this is indeed very clear evidence that the global warming is happening. The sea level rise comes from two components, actually. Part of it is from melting of glaciers, and part of it is from the expansion of the ocean as the oceans gradually warm up. And that's the largest component, the expansion of the oceans, but there's a non-trivial component from the melting of glaciers as well.
So if this were to continue happening on a linear basis with no acceleration of any kind, if you were to look ahead 100 years, you'd multiply that 1.5 inches by 10 and come up with, what, say, 15 inches or so of sea level rise?
Easily, yes. It's likely to expand somewhat.
Why?
Because there's some feedback effects. In high latitudes, as the snow and ice melts, the what we call the albedo, the reflectance of the planet, decreases. And so you have a dark surface and more solar radiation is received by the planet. And that provides what we call a positive feedback. It amplifies the original change. And so it actually helps to melt more ice than would in the first place. And we can see this happening in various parts of the Arctic right now, where in Glacier National Park in Alaska, there's a tremendous melting of glaciers going on. And so this is a thing which does cause amplification of the effects.
Now, you mentioned that the surface temperatures of the seas are high, particularly talking about the western Atlantic Ocean going into the Caribbean, where hurricanes can pick up a lot of energy. Now, as I understand it, a lot of that warm water actually comes up along the east side of the United States, the Gulf Stream. A lot of warmth comes north from that. Indeed, that's how much of the Northeast and, I guess, Europe is kept warm. And I also understand that there's been some concerns that this process might slow down. What the movie The Day After Tomorrow, in fact, tells a story. I don't think it's scientifically accurate, is it? That this all comes to a crunching halt and the northern part of the world freezes. But what is, in fact, going on with the changing sea surface temperatures down there where the Gulf Stream begins, and how might it affect us in the future?
Well, what you've said is essentially correct. Yes, in the Atlantic Ocean in particular, there is this circulation which we call the thermohaline circulation. And the thermo refers to temperature, and the haline refers to salt, the salinity of the ocean. And those are the two things that affect the density of the ocean. And so this is a density-driven current, and part of the surface manifestation of that is the Gulf Stream. And so this is a northward-moving warm current along the western side of the ocean. And then there is a somewhat cooler current on the eastern side of the ocean, but also there's a current at depth which comes back along the western side of the ocean that is part of this large-scale overturning. And with global warming, it's predicted that this thermohaline circulation will slow down. This means that there's less heat transported into the North Atlantic and potentially can cause a relative cooling in the European theater. This was taken to an extreme by the Day After Tomorrow, where they actually brought on an ice age. But it was based upon the whole idea that there could be a change in the thermohaline circulation as a consequence of global warming.
What are you seeing in terms of research data about that very possibility?
Well, a lot of the evidence seems to point in the direction that the thermohaline circulation is actually changing. And so this is an extra degree of complexity. It's not a simple matter of the whole of the globe warming up with global warming, but this creates regional differences. The warmest time in the North Atlantic was somewhere around about 1950. The late 1940s and the early 1950s was quite a warm period there. And in more recent times, it's cooled off a little bit, although it's relatively warm right at the moment. And it's warmed up in the tropical North Atlantic. And at the same time, the salinity of the ocean has changed. It's become more rainy in the north, which has made the salinity go down in the north. And at the same time, there's more evaporation in the tropics and subtropics, which has made the ocean more saline in the middle and low latitudes. And as a result, these changes are that we're observing within the ocean, a number of papers have been written about this now, are consistent with a slowing of the thermohaline circulation.
So this prediction that climate change could, in fact, lead to regional cooling, the data is showing some credence to this, that, in fact, this could be going on right now.
Except that in the real world, it could still warm in the North Atlantic, but just not as much as other parts of the planet. Or maybe it could cool very slightly for short periods of time, but it's unlikely, I think, to put us into an ice age and go completely in the other direction. And so that's where nature departs from the movie.
So what you're saying to me is that, in fact, North America, Eastern North America, might get a temporary break from the effects of global warming. It might not be quite as hot in this part of the world and in Europe as the rest of the world because of the ocean current situation, at least for a while?
Well, I'm not sure about northeastern parts of the United States. Certainly in Europe, they would feel the effects of this. It's a little harder to tell over the northeast parts of the U.S.
So, but Europe might get, in fact, a break from the overall rise in temperatures around the globe, for a short period of time, anyway.
Well, if this is the dominant thing that's going on, the trouble is there are other things going on as well. And, you know, there were some warning signs in Europe when last year they had major heat waves. And the situation that led to those heat waves, I think part of the ingredients of that were occurring in the Indian Ocean. And so changes in other parts of the tropics can also have ramifications that might move things in another direction. And how all these things play out is a level of complexity that I'm not sure we have really good predictions on at the current time.
When people hear your work, there you are, a little social gathering, and you say that you run the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, they must ask you, well, what's going to happen to us? What do you tell them?
Well, I certainly come across with the message that global warming is happening. The climate of the future is going to be different than it has been in the past. Most of our activities are actually based on the assumption that the future will be similar to the past. And so we plan our crops, if you're dealing with agriculture or how we run our forests or fisheries and so on, based upon the past weather. Well, those assumptions are going to be false. And so we'd better start thinking about this thing a little differently and making plans for the idea that the climate will be different in the future. And we've got some reasonably good ideas as to the nature of some of those changes. It relates indeed to having heavier, more intense rainfall events, but perhaps a little fewer and farther between. And so that increases the risk of droughts in some parts of the country. And, you know, in the southwestern parts of the United States, we have still got major droughts going on and big deficits in some of the lakes that are very critical for human consumption and other uses.
The short list, then, of changes you would expect to see over the next few decades.
Well, certainly increased risk of heat waves and wildfires is a consequence of that. The mountain areas are very vulnerable for increased risk of drought because of reduced snowpack. This affects also the southwestern parts of the United States, an increased risk of drought and wildfires. I think overall around the world, the biggest pressure point is likely to be the availability of water and the changes in water. Managing water will be an increased challenge to us because of increased demand as well as changes in the nature of the supply.
What do you know about how insurance companies might be preparing for the increased costs associated with the more severe weather patterns that are predicted with climate change?
Well, the key thing with insurance companies is that a lot of their loss is reinsured with the big reinsurance companies. These are companies like Swiss Re and Munich Re. And so these are the companies that insure the insurance companies, and they're very concerned about climate change. They've already suffered a lot of extreme weather-related losses, especially the last 10 or 15 years, and climate change is high on their agenda. They're trying to adjust their risks based upon predictions in the future, but often individual insurance companies can't fully make the risk match the premiums because they're required by law or because of in order to do other kinds of business in the area, they have to keep their premiums at an unrealistic low value. And so I think this is one of the things that certainly should happen, is that the true risk should match the actual assessed risk.
In other words, somebody who builds a multimillion-dollar house on a barrier island, say in North Carolina or off the Georgia or the Florida coast, perhaps should be paying more?
I think so. I mean, I have no objection to them doing that as long as they're taking the risk. But if I, out in Colorado, have to pay an increase in my insurance fees in order to help them rebuild when they get damaged, then that's something that I and I think many others should object to.
So what do you think we should be doing about all of this?
Well, there's several things. One is that recognize that it's happening and we should begin to plan for it in various ways. There are certainly actions that individuals can take to help to try to mitigate the problem. And so in the United States, you know, we drive a lot of SUVs, but there's options available through hybrid vehicles, for instance, and cutting down on the use of energy. Those are the kinds of things that can make a bit of difference. But it's a global problem. It's one which is international in scope. And so the international agreements that have been reached to try to mitigate the problem, to prevent the problem from getting too bad, is the Kyoto Protocol. But the U.S. has opted out of that at the current time. And so the critical thing is what can be done on an international basis and whether countries can come together in a concerted effort to at least slow down this problem so that we can plan for it and adapt to it as it's happening, because I don't think we can make it go away.
Before I came into the studio to talk with you, Kevin Trenberth, I was talking with somebody who raised a question. Well, there must be some parts of the United States that'll be okay with global warming, that people will be better off to be than others. Are there such places?
Global warming is not necessarily bad. The climate may well get better in various parts of the country. And, you know, in Canada and in Russia, they think global warming, the idea of things being warmer, sounds pretty good. But the problem is the change and the rate of the change and whether you can accommodate the rates of change. If the change is slow enough, then you can adapt to it and it's not necessarily a problem. But if the change is too fast, too sudden, then you can't readily adapt to it or plan to it. And, you know, in Siberia, for instance, you know, warming might be good, but they've got a whole lot of infrastructure which is based on the idea that there's permafrost and there's frozen soils and there are pipelines running across it. And if suddenly those soils melt, then the pipelines break and you can have a lot of damage. And we're seeing some of that, for instance, in Alaska, where some of the largest warming is occurring. And so it's the rate of change which is more an issue rather than the nature of climate change per se.
And the flip side of that question, what parts of the United States are most at risk from the effects of climate change in the comparatively near future?
certainly the marginal zones, semi-arid regions with regard to water, the increased risk of drought. You know, in the United States, east of the Rockies, one of the things that's happened is that in general the U.S. has become wetter, and that's been one of the main manifestations. It hasn't warmed up quite as much as some other parts of the world. And if there's water lying around, that helps to act as an air conditioner. The heat goes into evaporating moisture, but it does mean that the nature of the weather changes somewhat, and whether you can adapt to that readily with whatever activities you have in terms of agriculture, planting, or various other kinds of things. You know, I think in the U.S. it's probably less of a problem. It's other parts of the world where other systems, health systems, diseases, effects of extra insects on crops and things like that could have adverse effects.
What does this likelihood of stronger hurricanes mean for someplace like the Everglades?
Well, the Everglades are very low-lying, of course, and the problem with the problem really comes down to, firstly, the higher sea level by itself. Secondly, when you have high tide, and then there is a storm surge on top of that. When those three things come together, suddenly the damage goes, as we might say, non-linear. Suddenly there are catastrophes and huge chunks of the coastline might disappear altogether and get washed out to sea. Sand beaches can get washed away. Big changes can occur in very short times if those things come together. And I believe that with Hurricane Ivan that we were a little bit lucky that the main landfall occurred when it was relatively low in tide, although I'm not exactly sure about that. But, you know, sooner or later these things will come together in places like New Orleans, which has a number of areas that are below sea level, are apt to cough it sooner or later.
So New Orleans is really looking down the barrel of a gun, is what you're saying to me.
I think that's true in the longer term, yes.
Earlier in our program, we were talking with Republican Senator John McCain, who, along with Democrat Joe Lieberman, has been pushing a measure for mandatory control of climate-changing gases. And he talks about becoming very concerned about the science in this area. What do you see, if anything, in the political mood in this country about climate change that is changing? You've been working on this for a long time.
Well, I think it's certainly encouraging what Lieberman and McCain have been doing and that they have made some progress. And there is some education of the Congress going on. But the situation in the U.S. has not been encouraging, I don't think, from the standpoint of the administration with regard to taking this issue very seriously. And, of course, there are vested interests that are very much involved in this because it's very much involved with the whole issue of energy and energy use.
How much time do we have left to address climate change from your perspective?
It's not a matter of having to do this tomorrow. It's a longer-term problem. The problems are, you know, looming decades, 50 years, 100 years into the future. But it's one which you have to start because once we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it hangs around for 100 years or longer. And so we have not already seen the full manifestations of what we have done up until now. The oceans are still warming. They're still adjusting to what we've already done. And as a result, I think the need is to begin, but begin in modest ways. And I happen to think it's not so much what you do. It's actually how you go about doing it and whether you do it in the right way and on the right time frame. And it doesn't have to be disruptive to the economy if you do it right.
Kevin Trenberth is head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks for taking this time with me today, Kevin.
You're most welcome.